gentlemen. The terrible elephant man. Turn around.
Turn around. Turn around. Hello and welcome back to On Lynch, a podcast where I go on a deep dive of the works of David Lynch. My name is Mackenzie. Hi! Welcome back. Breaking a little bit of the formality here at the top to say thank you for coming back for episode 3, especially after I, disappeared for 2 months. I'm really excited to dive back into this project. I've missed it. I've missed talking to all of you. I'm back. We're back, baby. Okay? We're here. We're talking about Lynch, and I'm so excited because today we are discussing David Lynch's 1980 follow-up to Eraserhead, The Elephant Man. The Elephant Man is a story I love. Years ago, I was studying abroad in London, and I got to see the revival of the Bernard Pomerantz play, The Elephant Man. So, same name, two different entities, still the same story. And it starred Bradley Cooper and Patricia Clarkson, and it was amazing. It was one of the most staggeringly beautiful, heartbreaking, and riveting pieces of theater I had ever seen. And upon returning to the States that very year, I would then go on to be an actor in a production of the exact same play. And living in that world for a few weeks as a performer made the story all the more special to me. I think I probably came to this film, watching it this time for this podcast, with a lot more love at the jump, only because this is a story that's been kind of close to me for many years. And watching Lynch's take on this film made me love it more. I'm so excited to discuss it with you today. So, as always, I say, having there been only one other episode before like this, but as always, let's dive into the production of the film first.
On the basis of Eraserhead, your first feature, which you made while you're at the American Film Institute in Los Angeles, Mel Brooks tapped you to direct The Elephant Man. Why did he pick an independent filmmaker of your particular vision to make a true-life Victorian drama with John Gielgud and Anthony Hopkins?
This is one of the great mysteries of life.
After Eraserhead, David Lynch was finishing a script for a film he called Ronnie Rocket. He's spoken a lot about this script and how he couldn't find a way to get it made as he was finding no interest in it from financial backers. And just as a side note, if anyone's interested, the story of Ronnie Rocket would have gone something like this, according to Lynch. Quote, "The story of a detective seeking to enter a mysterious second dimension, aided by his ability to stand on one leg. He is being obstructed on his quest by a strange landscape of odd rooms and a threatening train, while being stalked by the Donut Men, quote-unquote, who wield electricity as a weapon." In addition to this detective story, the film was to show the tale of Ronald, a 3-foot-tall teenager who suffers a surgical mishap which leaves him dependent on being plugged into an electrical supply at regular intervals. This dependence grants him affinity over electricity, which he can use to produce music or cause destruction. The boy names himself Ronnie Rocket, becomes a rock star, and befriends a tap dancer named Electrocute. Apparently this is going to involve a lot of the themes that would go on to be prominent in Lynch's work, including 1950s culture, dimensions between worlds, electricity, and so on. Honestly, feels pretty Twin Peaks to me.
Ronnie Rocket it's an absurd comedy, a frightening comedy, but it's set in a 50s industrial world. Or a couple of different worlds, and it's a film about electricity, and Ronnie himself is about 3 feet tall, or maybe 3.5, with physical problems, and this fantastic pompadour red hair.
Honestly, I still want to see this. So David Lynch, if you're listening, Can the world get Ronnie Rocket? Call me. Also, if you're listening, hi, do you want to come on the podcast? All right, back to Elephant Man. One day, Lynch gets a call from a man named Stuart Kornfeld, who there was a very funny interview with him where he talked about how he just liked the name Kornfeld. I love that about him. And he loved Eraserhead, Kornfeld, that is. And he wanted to invite Lynch to lunch to discuss how they could work together. They went to lunch, and Lynch told him all about his next idea, Ronnie Rocket. Kornfeld worked really hard to call around and shop the script to see if they could get it picked up by a studio, to no avail. Eventually, Lynch was feeling like he needed to make a move in his career. If his original piece couldn't get picked up, then he thought maybe there was a script already written that he could direct. He called Stewart and asked about scripts, to which Kornfeld immediately responded, "Yeah, I have some ideas for you." So yet again, they go to lunch to discuss, and as soon as Lynch hears the words, "The Elephant Man."
And a bomb went off in my head. I said, "That's it."
The script they had was one already written by Christopher DeVore and Eric Bergen. They began shopping it around in similar ways as Ronnie Rocket, but also couldn't get anyone to bite. Lynch himself said studios told him, quote, "No one wants this movie about a monster," which, woof, I wonder if they realized how much their opinions would be present in the life of Joseph Merrick. But after a while, it did eventually get in the hands of a producer who wanted it. Kornfeld was friends with Anne Bancroft. Anne Bancroft, who plays Mrs. Kendall, loved the script and got it in the hands of her friend Mel Brooks. Yes, that Mel Brooks, who was starting his production company Brooks Films. Mel Brooks immediately wanted this to be the first film that would be produced by Brooks Films. Brooks Films had a few comedies coming up, but as the story goes, as soon as Brooks read the script, he said, "I want this to be the first thing we really put our weight behind." Mel Brooks was ready to move forward with everything as soon as possible, but was confused about who this no-name director was. So, he wanted to see Eraserhead before he committed to signing Lynch on to direct.
And I heard this, and I said, "It's been great knowing you guys." And so the screening was set up, and for some reason, I was asked to be outside when the film finished. And you can sort of imagine my condition. But the doors burst open, and here comes Mel Brooks running at me, arms wide open, saying, "You're a madman. I love you. You're in."
Thank you for correcting.
And that's the big story. Everybody always talks about how did Mel Brooks get involved in this, and that is it from the man himself. So Lynch made some rewrites to the script, citing that the original captured the soul of Joseph Merrick, and that's why he loved it, but he still needed to add some of his own ideas and more dramatic tension with a more apparent arc. The film was cast with some of the greatest actors of that time. They flew to London to film in classic Victorian locations. This was a real film, and the filming, compared to Eraserhead, only took a few months. The other major thing that came from this production was that iconic makeup. Christopher Tucker was the designer they brought on after Lynch realized he wouldn't be able to create the makeup in the way he wanted himself. He did all the makeup on Eraserhead, and he wanted to continue that, but found he couldn't. Tucker was a godsend to Lynch. He was able to use the casts of the real Merrick's body from the London Hospital's museum of him to build the makeup for the film. So the makeup that you see throughout the film is based off of Merrick's actual face and body. It's a deeply authentic view of how he would have looked. And this was also Lynch's first film to have Oscar buzz.
The reviews and the things that came from it, again, were, you know, just like blessings. And it was just suddenly, you know, very, very big. And I was in Paris doing promotion for the release of The Elephant Man in Paris, in France, when I was having these pomme frites, these French fries, that were the best French fries, and doing interviews, and I kept asking for more of these French fries. And the phone rings, and it's my wife saying that, you know, this film just got 8 Academy Award nominations. We didn't win one, but we got 8 nominations.
Though The Elephant received no wins that year, it was a year where Ordinary People and Raging Bull kind of swept, it was still a huge deal for showing that Lynch could have critical acclaim behind his work. Christopher Tucker's makeup, even, was so impressive that it led to the creation of the Academy Award for Best Makeup. He sadly wasn't awarded an Oscar for his work in this movie, but there were so many complaints that the film wasn't recognized for its incredible feat in makeup design that they literally made the category the very next year. It wouldn't exist without Elephant Man. The Elephant Man has stood the test of time in terms of being probably the most iconic and well-done portrayal of Joseph Merrick's life. And since this is all about him, I wanted to give some historical information and context for the real-life Joseph Merrick.
People are frightened by what they don't understand.
Most of Lynch's works aren't rooted in historical context or real-life human beings, which is why I think it's super important to take a look at the real-life Joseph Merrick this time, not only to remember him and his story, but to examine how his story has morphed and changed in media such as this film. Joseph Merrick is incorrectly referred to often, and even in this film, as John Merrick, due to another Merrick named John of no relation, who was born around the same time. His real name was Joseph. He was born on August 5th, 1862 in Leicester, England. He was born with no signs of deformities as a child. Most information on his youth and the development of his disease comes from a pamphlet produced in 1884. Around the age of 5, he began to show physical changes of, quote, thick, lumpy skin, like that of an elephant, and almost the same in color. As he grew, a noticeable difference between the size of his arms appeared, and both his feet became significantly enlarged. The Merricks, attempting to find a tangible reason for why Joseph's body was changing in this way, attributed it to the fact that his mother was knocked over and frightened by an elephant at the fair when she was pregnant with him, a reasoning Joseph himself held for the entirety of his life. This was most likely connected to an idea that at the time was called maternal impression, the concept that the emotional experiences of a pregnant person could have lasting physical effects on their unborn children. This idea was still very prominent in Britain at the time. Outside of his growths and abnormalities, he also suffered a very common hip injury from a fall he took, and that ended up becoming infected and leaving his left leg lame, leading to his unusual gait that's recreated in most depictions of him. Though his body was changing in ways that confounded the family, his youngest years were actually spent quite happily. He went to school and lived as normal of a life as he could, and was very close to his mother, Mary Jane. At the age of 11, though, sadly, his mother fell ill and died of pneumonia. Only a year later, Joseph's father remarried and moved in with his new bride, a widower herself with two children of her own. By the time he was 13, he was in self-described perfect misery. His father and stepmother both treated him terribly, offering him no love or warmth that a child should have at his age. He left school and found odd jobs, but as his condition worsened, he found it harder to keep a job, not to mention the judgment and horror that came from those who attempted to work around. So he spent his teenage years running away from home for a few days at a time, wandering the streets to avoid the onslaught of his parents' hatred towards him. His father began to view him more and more as a burden, and he proved unable to provide for himself. One day, at the age of 15, upon returning home, he was beaten so severely by his father that he decided to leave home for good. A young boy still and now homeless on the streets of England, he was sought out by an uncle who wanted to help the young man but could only afford to do so for so long, until Merrick had to go work in a workhouse, a place that offered shelter and labor to those who could not afford to support themselves. It was about age 20 where he underwent his first surgery. A growth on his mouth had made it to where he could barely speak, and he was beginning to make it harder for him to eat food. Once this growth was removed, he was able to begin speaking again, albeit not very articulately. And now in his story is where we begin to see sort of the events of the film. There's definitely a lot of liberties taken, but the beats are similar. Merrick determined his only hope for leaving the workhouse was to be an exhibition. It was the only thing he felt he was qualified to do. He met Sam Torr, a music hall comedian and proprietor who looked at Merrick and saw the money he could make from him. And at age 22, Merrick set out and began touring with Torr under the attraction name The Elephant Man, half man, half elephant. He eventually landed under the management of Tom Norman, who ran a shop for curiosities. The character we see in the film of Mr. Bites is kind of a mixture of Torr and Norman, I would say. He had a small bedroom and private area built for Merrick, and in a zoo-like experience, onlookers would walk by and take a peek in while being informed of his life story. The aforementioned pamphlet, where a lot of the information about him came from, was actually produced for this exhibit, and it made a decent amount of money. And thankfully, Merrick was given a share of the profits from the pamphlet, saving up for what he hoped could one day be a home of his own. Tom Norman's shop was on Whitechapel Road, directly across the street from London Hospital, where a young doctor named Frederick Treves worked. Frederick arranged for a private viewing. This began a series of examinations Treves and Merrick would go on to have. Treves noted that Merrick was often, quote, shy, confused, but not frightened in the least. Merrick, on the other hand, would eventually note that he felt degraded by these visits. Stripped naked, like an animal in the cattle market, he said. Eventually, he had enough and stopped going to see Treves, but sadly for him, this also coincided with the shop being shut down. Public concern about human attractions were growing, and people found it to be indecent and degrading, therefore shutting down many shops of the like around the city. Of course, these people did not seem to care about the people who really needed to make livings this way. They just cared about what they thought was indecent. We see this a bit in the opening sequence of the film, in terms of showing that the public was having a pretty strong response to this. Merrick was forced to go on tour, though police presence of violently shutting down these shows continued. This was a huge controversial political thing, these shows. People like Merrick struggled to find a way to support themselves with the public outcry and violent response from the police. He was passed from manager to manager to manager and eventually landed with a manager who would steal his entire life savings, an equivalent of about £6,000 today, leaving him abandoned with no money and nowhere to go. He roamed the city alone, attempting to beg strangers for help, but was only met with disgust and horror. Reminds me of the scene near the end of the film. But he contacted Treves for the first time in months, and Treves came to his side to help. He was transferred to London Hospital, where for the rest of his life he would remain. As I said, most of the film and the original play even are based off of these years of his life, as Frederick Treves wrote a book about his studies on Joseph. Francis Carr Gomme, the chairman of the hospital committee, was very supportive in taking in Merrick for help and examination. Treves discovered some underlying health issues and worried about his longevity, but he also found that the care from the hospital staff, as well as the kindness from them, helped improve not only his physical well-being, but his mental health. After a few months of him being there, Gomme began to worry about the institution's ability to keep him there, as he had an incurable disease and would theoretically be there for an indefinite amount of time. We definitely see this in the movie. Gomme wrote a letter to the Times, a daily newsletter in London, telling the story of Merrick's plight and asking readers for suggestions on how they could help Joseph. The public response was significant in a way they couldn't have predicted. The outpouring of letters and support and financial donations made it possible for Gomme to appeal to the hospital board to ensure that Merrick could stay at the hospital for the remainder of his life. The film shows that Alexandra, Princess of Wales, was the main proponent in him staying at the hospital. And while that's not completely true, eventually in his life he would receive many visits and gifts from the princess, and he considered her a friend. In the meantime, Treves and Merrick built a friendship where they would have long days of talking and intellectual sparring as friends. They became quite close. Treves would note that Joseph wore his emotions on his sleeves. He was a sensitive young man. He also expressed a yearning of women. The only woman he had ever really known not to be frightened of him was his mother. And Treves asked for his friend, Mrs. Layla Marturin, to visit Merrick. And her experience with him has kind of been pushed onto the characters of Anne and Mrs. Kendall in the film. Layla and Joseph's meeting was lovely, but a short one, as Merrick was overcome with emotion. He would tell Treves she was the first woman to ever smile at him and shake his hand. She was a very important person to him. They kept in close contact via letters, and the only surviving letter written by Merrick is to Layla, thanking her for the gift of a book she had given him. After this meeting, Joseph was filled with a new sense of self-confidence. He filled his days with art, model building, as we see in the film, reading, writing, small walks in the courtyard outside his room. He was happy and content. Another result of these letters written by Carr Gomme was that Merrick became quite a fascination for people of high society. An actress named Madge Kendall took a particular interest in his plight, and she was actually responsible for raising a lot of awareness and public sympathy for Merrick. The two actually never met in real life. That is a huge artistic difference between basically every production of The Elephant Man and real life. But she would send him letters and photos of herself, and she even employed a basket weaver to give him lessons, so he was very aware of her and very grateful for her support. Other people from high society visited him, gave him extravagant gifts, spent time with him, took him to the theater, and made him feel like one of them. They loved him and had a deep sympathy for his situation, feelings totally different than most people from the first part of his life. The 4 years he spent at the hospital were happy ones indeed. Though he was happy, his health was still deteriorating. His growths were continuing to grow, and it was clearly affecting the rest of his health. The afternoon of April 11th, 1890, he was found dead in his room at the age of 27. Sprawled across his bed, his death was ruled accidental, and the certified cause of death was asphyxia caused by the weight of his head as he laid down. Treves, who performed an autopsy, said Merrick died of a dislocated neck. Knowing that Merrick had always slept sitting upright out of necessity, Treves concluded that Merrick must have, quote, made the experiment, attempting to sleep lying down like other people. This was the life of the real Joseph Merrick. I will say that though I have loved this story for a long time, my first watch of the Lynch film was for this podcast. I was going into it ready to love it, so I think I was really able to focus on the filmmaking. And I think it's impossible to watch this sophomore feature and not see the influences of Eraserhead in it. It really is a perfect stepping stone from Lynch's purest form, right, to mainstream film. It has all the imagery Lynch loves to live in, industrial settings, physical deformities, electricity, but it's elevated by the material and Academy Award-nominated performances. I think it's nothing unique to say that Lynch is a filmmaker who loves to explore binary oppositions. Good versus evil, light versus dark. He enjoys showing us the seedy underbelly beneath the pristine exterior. This goes on to be prominent in basically all of his works, in my opinion. This story in particular is one of dichotomies, and the duality of life, I think, is something that Lynch is attracted to, so it makes sense to me that he would have been drawn to this story. I want to get into some of those dualities.
Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff.
Mr. Cargill?
Yes, what is it?
Stan. I didn't teach him that, huh?
And mercy will follow all the days of my life. And I will dwell in the house of the Lord.
How did you know the rest of it? I didn't teach you the rest of it.
It's very strange.
I know it really well, and the Book of Common Prayer. 23rd Psalm, beautiful, it's my favorite.
A major dichotomy in this story is spirituality, specifically Christianity, and science. Science is portrayed as cold, sterile. It's the analytical understanding of what is literally happening around us, whereas spirituality and Christianity has a level of faith, hope, and warmth to it. Treves in this story epitomizes science. He's a man who views Merrick at first simply as a project, not a human, but something that he can study and dissect. It's not until he connects with his own humanity through this relationship with John that he's able to warm up and let go of this scientific mind a bit more. In the film, the Princess of Wales comes and implores a board of scientists about to kick Merrick out from his home to, quote, do the Christian thing. They all immediately understand that the Christian thing is to offer kindness and empathy. Christianity and spirituality represent good in this world, and being a good Christian means that you're exuding a certain level of care to those who are struggling. Science, on the other hand, represents evil, or at least a lack of care about others around you. And I don't mean to say that to say the film is saying this is good and this is bad, because I think there's an argument to be made that the more scientifically minded characters have a bit more realism to them, a little bit more understanding on the situations around them. They don't weigh things wholly on faith alone, and that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing to be realistic about the scenarios around you. But then the other side shows that some of that faith is needed, because it brings hope, it brings happiness. In the play of the same name by Bernard Pomerantz, this duality is unpacked quite a bit more, even. There's a scene early on in the play with Gom, the man who runs the hospital, and a bishop that's visiting Merrick for a religious consultation as he moves into the hospital. The bishop and Gom discuss the nature of God and why it is that Treves is drawn to Merrick. Gom asks, "Is it not science, sir, that motivates us?" To which the bishop responds, "It is not. It is Christian duty. It is the obligation to bring our light to the benighted man that motivates us. As it motivates Treves towards Merrick, sir, to bring salvation where none is. The bishop almost alludes to the fact that the Christian duty we feel, this pull to care for other people, is natural. Science can be explained, but nature can't always be explained. In the film, I think that Merrick's deep spirituality is often used to show his goodness alongside his godliness. I love the scene where, to get over his anxieties about speaking up, he prays. He prays out loud. He prays loudly so that they know, I can speak. I can hear you. I understand. I'm scared. His faith comforts him. I think that showing how Merrick prays at the foot of God and Treves at the foot of scientific pursuits is an interesting dichotomy to show how these men move through the world differently, how they view things, and how their beliefs fuel how they view each other. Something else I love about the play is that it positions Merrick and Treves in composition often. Merrick has jealousies about Treves' intelligence and experience with women, his ability to move through the world respected and revered. Treves realizes that though he is normal, quote-unquote, by all definitions, he is lacking. He doesn't have a lust for life, a drive for curiosity, a faith that Merrick does. He doesn't have the same kind of loving demeanor and kindness that is just so innate in Merrick.
And then it says this. Then have my lips the sin that they have done. Sin from my lips? Oh, Christmas, sweetheart. Be my sin again. Oh, Mr. Merrick. You're not an elephant man at all. No? No. You're wrong.
Both in the play and in this film, my favorite part is the scene that revolves around Romeo and Juliet. The scene is so moving in many ways, but the arrival of Mrs. Kendall in his life, along with some of the most theatrical lines ever spoken, bring in this idea of illusion and performance. His life before being found by Dr. Treves was that of a performative nature. He was stared at and had no control as to how others viewed him. Mrs. Mothershead brings up a good point in the middle of the film. Even once he has found the acceptance he's always yearned for, it's still performative exploitation, just in a different way. In this film, what's important to John is being accepted. And even if it's not true, it's an illusion that he can wrap himself in. Much like acting. I think that's why Mrs. Kendall and John's relationship is really fascinating in the dichotomy of their lives. By his nature, he was sort of forcibly put onto a stage to be exploited and seen, whereas she sought this out. I think the play more so than the film dives into their relationship in a way I enjoy, but even here there is an understanding that Mrs. Kendall has with him as performers, creators of illusions and those who live in those illusions. That really connects them and gives her a deeper understanding of him as well as a deeper well of empathy for him. We see the power of illusion in the scene where he goes to the theater. Theater is a magical medium. I remember when I was in college for theater and the first show I worked on was Peter Pan. One of the most affirming moments for me as an artist was going out after the show and watching the kids meet the actor who played Peter. To these children, that is literally Peter Pan in front of them. That's not a person in a costume, but that's Peter Pan, flesh and blood. The magic of that illusion is so beautiful for kids, and I think in this scene in the movie, it shows us that John really never got the chance to be a kid. This illusion, that suspension of disbelief, is so real for him. And I think another reason why that's beautiful is because it shows the power of film itself. I think of Mulholland Drive. No hay banda. There is no band. In that movie, we're told all of this is an illusion. The art we're seeing, the sounds, the visuals, it's all fake. But then Rebecca Del Rio sings crying, and you feel this profound ache of emotion. It's all fake. It's an illusion, but it matters. It's profound. It can change someone's life. John's acceptance from those around him, sure, an illusion, but it changed his life for the better. The idea that he could grasp onto some of the normalcy he yearned for his whole life, it mattered, even if it wasn't always real. There's something sad about growing up. You lose those illusions. As I mentioned in both mediums, film and play, I love the interaction about Romeo and Juliet. I wanted to read my favorite interaction from the play for you all because I think it's important to this idea of illusions.
Romeo's are very undependable. Because he does not care for Juliet.
Not care?
Does he take her pulse? Does he get a doctor? Does he make sure? No. He kills himself. The illusion fools him because he does not care for her. He only cares about himself. If I had been Romeo, we would have gotten away.
But then there would be no play, Mr. Merrick.
If he did not love her, why should there be a play? Looking in a mirror and seeing nothing, that is not love. It was all an illusion. When the illusion ended, he had to kill himself.
When he sees himself in the mirror, he is confronted with the illusion he has built around himself. The illusion ends. These moments of him being shown his face are used to punctuate abuse and horrible moments in his life. He's being confronted with the fact that the illusion of normalcy he has begun to build can be shattered at any moment. It's heartbreaking to see. He deserves an illusion if that's what helps him move through his life that he's been so mistreated in. But his illusion shatters. And like Romeo's, it always makes me dwell on the ending. When the illusion ended, is that why he had to kill himself?
Never, oh never, nothing will die. The stream flows, the wind blows, the cloud faints, the heart beats.
There was a chapter of the play titled The Weight of Dreams, and that is such an evocative phrase for me, especially after seeing this film. In the play, it's the scene where John dies. Through the film, we see that John, Joseph in real life, was a man of superb intelligence with a beautiful heart and a compassion for those who didn't even deserve it all the time. He was caring and loved learning, seeing the best in those he met. He had a mind full of grandiose dreams. Merrick in the play posits that maybe his head had grown so large because it was so full of dreams. Dreams that Treves, Kendall, and other people don't possess. Their dreams didn't weigh them down like his did. His dreams weighed him down so much they could break his neck. There's a lot of debate around his death, namely the intentionality of it. I want to say content warning for talk of suicide. I think that both sources I'm looking at, the play and the film, have a different approach to this ending. The play, I think, leans into a possible suicidal motive. Knowing he was nearing the end of his life, he was not only yearning to free himself from the physical pain he was feeling as his conditions worsened, but in the production, Treves, in a moment of rage, implodes Merrick's ideas of himself. Treves, really, is the one who shatters the illusion. And as Merrick says about Romeo, when the illusion ended, he had to kill himself. He decides to do this, knowing he will die, but that he will do so sleeping as others, something he always wanted, and, really, on his own terms, which is taking back a lot of the autonomy he was robbed of during his life. I think it's interesting to see that interpretation that I've loved for a long time against Lynch's. To me, it seems that Lynch's Merrick makes a decision thinking of it as maybe a calculated risk. There's almost a childlike naivete to the way he decides to do this. He doesn't know for sure what will happen, but he doesn't think he'll die. In the film, the lead-up to this is him being actually quite happy, an antithesis to the play, so an intentional death isn't what Lynch's ending reads to me. I'm going back and forth on this so much after seeing the film and juxtaposing it with the play and maybe even real life. There is one part of me that thinks that maybe this is just his childlike illusion, yearning to sleep like others that led him to making a decision that would ultimately kill him, unintentionally. The film takes a lot of time in Merrick looking at photos on the wall of kids sleeping in their beds. It almost seems like Lynch is showing that these pictures inspired Merrick to try. I actually don't know if I love this choice. I think it takes away a lot of his agency and almost diminishes his intelligence. Based on what we see, it's hard for me to believe a man as smart as him wouldn't have thought through what would happen to him if he were to sleep on his back. So Lynch's film almost gives me a less satisfying ending than other interpretations of it. Where I think it brings back a lot of the enjoyment for me is the final moments with his mother. The idea that they get to be reunited, and by her poem's words, he will truly never die. It's a beautiful thought. His story has truly survived the ages, and part of him never really died because his words, his beauty, and his life are always with us in these stories. And in the end, it doesn't matter how he died. It's that he lived. That's what matters.
I can't tell you how sorry I am for what happened. You see, I had no idea. Please, you mustn't blame yourself. Mr. Trees, don't worry about me, my friend. I am happy every hour of the day. My life is full because I know that I am loved.
The story of Joseph Merrick is one of my favorite stories ever told. He was a man who was dealt a horrific hand in life, a life of abuse, hatred, ogling, disgust, but through all of that, his soul shined through. Through everything he went through, he always chose to be kind. I feel like sometimes it can get caught up in the classic phrase everyone's parents tells them, never judge a book by its cover, and that's true. Those who saw Joseph Merrick shouldn't have judged his soul so horrifically. That phrase is important, but it's even more important to remember that he literally lived this. This is a movie, but he was a real person. I think the moniker of the Elephant Man and even John, the wrong name that has permeated so many of these stories, erase the fact that he was just a person who was doing his best. He was a human being and he deserved so much more. His story is a tricky one to tell. By showing him on screen or on stage, are we reducing his memory to a sideshow attraction yet again? I think when it's done well, no, it doesn't. And I think this movie is done beautifully. I love this movie. I love how much this story aligns with the themes that David Lynch loves. And I just think it's a beautiful piece of art. I understand why it's one of Lynch's most accessible films, because it's a human story that we can all relate to. It's amazing, and I'm obviously endlessly impressed by David Lynch as a director. I'm really glad I watched this. Thank you for joining me for this episode of On Lynch. If you'd like to connect, you can find the podcast on Instagram or Twitter at On Lynch Podcast, or go to onlynchpodcast.com to email me your thoughts, or simply send me an email at onlynchpodcast@gmail.com. On the website, you'll also find information about David Lynch's works and eventually a full transcription of this episode if you'd like to read along and see source citations. I'm a bit behind on transcripts, but I will be getting them up. If you'd like to support the show, head over to anchor.fm/onlynch to make a monthly donation or leave a review on Apple Podcasts. And with that, I'll see you next time on Lynch, where I will be discussing Dune. Yes, Dune. Have a good day. I wish you blue skies and golden sunshine all along the way.